On the phone, ladies and gentlemen, it's January 20th. It's Tuesday. I'm in Amherst, Massachusetts at Amherst Media, and on the telephone live in Crescent City, California with Derek Jensen. Derek Jensen, many of you, if all of you don't know this, shame on you. Derek Jensen, for years now has been one of our most important voices, a great writer, and someone who has affected many of us very deeply. I want to tell you that it's an honor to have you come and talk to us, and I will always be grateful for much of your early work, especially because it just broke me open as a person. And I know that I'm speaking for God knows how many tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people can attest to that as well. So I want to just express my deep gratitude to you.
Oh, well, thank you so much for saying that.
Yes, sir. I'm glad to hear that you're well, reasonably well. Let's see. What I had in mind, I've given a lot of thought to what we might talk about, or what I'd like to hear, what I'd like to propose that we talk about. Among them are, I'd like to begin by talking about men and manhood and maleness and real men and men in our current historical context and cultural context. Beyond that, I'm interested in talking about pathology, about the terrible sickness in our culture and in ourselves that is showing every indication of taking us down and out as a failed species, or as a species whose particular lifespan has reached its destination. And beyond that, talk about different aspects of the culture, if that's all agreeable with you.
That sounds great.
I would like to first of all invite you to maybe talk about anything that may be very prominent in your heart or on your mind today or these days. Aside from that, I'll direct us into the bulk of what I'm interested in talking about.
Well, I'll just say briefly that I'm doing the final read through on a book before I send it off to the publisher, and the book is on human supremacism, which I think is probably the biggest problem facing the world today, the belief that humans are superior to and separate from everyone else. And this is going to segue right into the male supremacism problem that we can talk about very soon. So anyway, I'm excited to be finishing the book. In manuscript pages, it's like 510 or something. Just before I called here, I write the book, and then after the whole thing is done, I print the whole thing out and read it through one final time, and I'm up to page 249 of reading it through. So I'll probably be done with it in a couple days and send it off. I'm pretty happy with it. And that, I think, is central to a lot of the problems we face, is this belief that humans or males or whites or civilized humans or whomever are superior to everyone else. I think that one of the worst ideas that humans ever came up with, or humans in this culture ever came up with, is the great chain of being. The notion that God is on the top, and then comes angels, and then comes kings, and then comes other men, and then comes women, and then comes and that's all of the civilized. And then there's, you know, so-called primitive peoples who are partway between human and animal, according to this idea. And then comes, animals, then plants, then and we can say, and the notion is really comes from, and it really is tied in with the whole, divine right of kings, where God appointed the king to be superior to everybody else. And that divine right of kings is really sort of extended out to be the divine right of humans at this point, or the divine right of machines even. And is a tremendously harmful notion. It ties into something else that we can hit all through the day, which is that any oppressor, naked force is not the best form, the best way to propagate one's ability to oppress. That it's much better if you can convince everybody else to go along with you. You can naturalize your oppression, make the oppression seem natural, make it seem as though that is your natural role. So the king's natural role is to rule, or the man's natural role is to be superior to women, or human's natural role is to manage. Things like the selfish gene really push this, that all of nature is this fight to compete and to exploit everybody else before they exploit you. And that's, of course, just capitalism projected onto the natural world. I'm just giving a real quick overview. So yeah, that's what I'm working on and thinking about right now. So now we can go to wherever you want to go with this.
Well, everything goes in every other direction. There is an understandable desire for some sort of order to superimpose on the sometimes seemingly chaotic nature of life. We do like some predictability or some sort of order. I think it's misplaced. I think we could have our needs met if we determine first of all honestly what they are. I'm sure we can find ways to satisfy our fundamental human needs without falling into the terrible dilemma of destruction and cruelty and human to human predation and human to other predation. I'd like to begin by talking about men and about manhood. Because it seems such a giant split between the all too common behavior of many, many men in this world and the internal sense I think that most men have of wishing to have a manhood of integrity, to be real men in the finest sense, to express feelings of honor and courage, and to be strong and to express that strength in the world in positive ways, and yet men seem beaten down and broken and humiliated in many ways by the system or by each other. So I'd like to talk a little bit about manhood, about whether the fact that it's the 21st century now and not the seventh, whether manhood changes over the centuries, or the state of manhood, or the failure of manhood.
Well, I don't know that I necessarily agree that men are particularly beaten down at this point, when we consider that there are more women and children who die every year through sex-based violence, by which I don't mean sexually motivated, by which I mean that men kill them, like domestic partner violence, than are killed in all the wars in the world. And that, men hold the positions of power, and they hold the levers of power in this culture. And the women who hold levers of power, like Hillary Clinton or Margaret Thatcher back when she was holding those levers of power, generally take on what would be stereotypically masculine characteristics. And when we have science, which is there's a great line by Theodore Roszak I want to try to find real quick, that is hold on. See if I can find it.
Had you met Dr. Roszak?
I did. Okay, here's the quote. If feminist psychology is correct, the very concept of scientific objectivity as a disciplined withdrawal of sympathy by the knower from the known is a male separation anxiety writ large, written in fact upon the entire universe. So the point I want to get to is that I think that if we go way back, I think one of the problems, I wrote this piece a couple years ago. I became friends with Eve Ensler, and she was going to do a male version of the Vagina Monologues, and it was going to be called The Man Box. So she asked me to write a piece for that, and the larger piece that she was going to do, the theater piece, never actually developed. But I really liked the thing I wrote, and central to what I was writing in that book, or what was writing that piece, is the notion that how a man becomes a man in this culture is by identifying others as, it's based on the supremacism I was talking about, that what you do is you cut off your empathy and then you identify others as inferior to you, and you then, the way you manifest your superiority over them is by violating them. And this works with human supremacism too, that how do we know that we are superior to trees? Well, we know we're superior to them because we violate them. They don't violate us. We cut them down. They don't kill us. How do we know we're superior to prairie dogs? Because we wipe them out. They don't wipe us out. It's all based on, and I agree with you, by the way, what you said a minute ago about how we do need to make order out of the universe. I completely agree, but I go back to what so many indigenous people have said to me, which is that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really works, mm-hmm. the world really is. Mm-hmm. And so another way to put this is that we Westerners generally perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited. And traditionally, indigenous peoples would generally perceive the world as consisting of other beings to enter into relationship with. And life is this giant symphony. I'm gonna try to find, there's a wonderful quote by Vine Deloria that I'm gonna try to find real fast too.
I have it I have it blocked out here. I wanted to put it on the record also. If I may, if it's the same quote.
Is it one about symphony?
No. I'm gonna read it. It says, it's at the front of, one of the late chapters in A Language Older Than Words, Connection and Cooperation. Vine Deloria Jr. is quoted, "The future of mankind lies waiting for those who will come to understand their lives and take up their responsibility to all living things."
Yeah, that's a wonderful quote. And the one I was, and it is associated with the one I was thinking of. And the one I was thinking of is, life is not a predatory jungle, red in tooth and claw, as Western ideology likes to pretend, but a symphony of mutual respect in which each player has a specific part to play. We must be in our proper place and play our role at the proper moment. And I love that. And it's, so yes, I completely agree that, and here's a problem I have with, and I've got a book coming out in a couple years about some of the problems in anarchism. And one of the problems in so much anarchism is that, at least in especially like parts of it, like anarcho-primitivism, is they seem to believe that just because the stories told by this culture are toxic, that then all stories end up being toxic. And it's a leap I don't agree with. And so since some of the restrictions placed on us by this culture are onerous and inappropriate, that all strictures placed on all behavior are onerous and inappropriate. And I completely disagree with that. But anyway, back to the point is that, yes, I do think we can make sense of the world in a way that does not foster, destructive behavior. And we can make sense of the world in a way. I'm much more interested in being in this incredibly morally complex and an incredibly complex world where everyone is interacting with each other as different beings who have different roles to play in. So it's like there's some research done. I just cracks me up that it ends up that when caterpillars start to chew on certain leaves, if they start to chew on the leaves of certain plants, first off, the plants will change the composition of the leaves to make them so they don't taste good, or they make them so the caterpillars get sick. They'll do this. They can't run away, so they have to figure out some way to keep from getting eaten. So what they'll do is change the composition of the leaves. But it's not just that. They will also communicate with other plants and tell other plants that to change that. So say I'm a plant and I'm getting chewed on. I will send out messages through chemicals that you can then receive. You live next to me. You then receive them and you change the composition of your leaves before the caterpillars get there, because I've warned you. I've said, hey, the caterpillars are coming. You change the composition before they get there. And there are scientists who are asking what I think is a really, really stupid question. They're asking, gosh, how could this possibly be? Why would that plant clue in its competitors? And they'll do this for plants of other species. And that's the problem right there, is the word competitor as opposed to the word neighbor. Right. And the reason that the plants will clue in their neighbors is because they understand that a forest consists of more than alder trees, but it consists of alder and cascara and willow and redwood and cedar. And it includes the caterpillars too. It includes all those. They understand that life isn't a game of risk where you try to conquer everybody and be the last one on the planet. And this takes us back to at least my perception of masculinity, is that within this culture, masculinity has been turned into this thing where, it's this competition where we are even based on selfish genes, where everybody is trying to exploit everybody else, and the one who does it the best is the most manly. That's the winner. That's the king. That's the one in charge. And in order to do that, you have to, once again, perceive others as inferior. But how do the whites perceive the blacks as inferior? I'm thinking, of course it still happens, but I'm thinking especially of through chattel slavery. It's like, well, the reason we know we're superior to them is because we are the ones who own them. It's a tautology, and it's a self-serving tautology. And one of the things that happens is because this notion, this violation imperative that's at the core of patriarchy, which is once again, I violate, therefore I am. It becomes that this act of violation is not merely a, something you do, but it becomes part of your identity. And each new person you meet, each new being you meet, is a new threat to your sense of superiority. Yeah. And so you have to violate each new being you encounter. That's why this culture, I'm doing a very poor job of describing this, I'm sorry, but that's why this culture has to bomb the moon. That's why it has to probe the deepest folds of the ocean. Right. That's why it has to bomb asteroids. Yeah. That's why it has to, every indigenous culture must, their land must be taken. Yeah. And it becomes a sensational thing. I love this line by R.D. Lang. How do you plug a void plugging a void? And, okay, the problem, I think, is that we are separated from ourselves, and we are separated from our sense of community, and we're isolated by this patriarchal mythology, and that leaves an emptiness. And when we try to fill this emptiness using violations, but violations can never fill the emptiness made by relationship. And I mean, I'm sorry, I can never fill the violations can never fill the emptiness filled by a lack of relationship, is what I meant. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes insatiable. If you try, and think of it in another way, is that let's say you're feeling really empty and lonely, and so what you do is you go, you buy a bunch of stuff. And that may feel okay for a minute. You can get a rush from buying stuff, but it's going to go away, and then you're going to be empty again. And that void is, and you're going to have to keep doing that. And it's the same with conquest. It's the same with, it ultimately leaves you empty, and not that existential void didn't get filled, that existential void that could have been filled by knowing who you are and feeling who you are in place, in relationship. And so it ends up being insatiable. And I don't see, as long as that violation imperative remains in place, I don't see I don't see how anything will change. It's an addiction that is, yeah, it's an addiction that's fueling, so much of what we see around us.
Mm-hmm. That's an expression of being terrified.
Yeah, I completely agree with that too. That it's, you know, I saw this collection of public service announcements about domestic violence one time, and there was one that was pretty interesting. It was a poster of a man. Okay, it had a child in front running from a man who was going to hit him, and then there was picture like four or five males around a table, and the smallest one is a boy who's being chased by the man, and then go in front of the boy and you have a boy who's a little bit bigger, and then basically it shows the boy growing up around the table, and when he comes back around, he's the adult who was chasing the child. Mm. And each one of them, and so basically it was showing that, you know, this terror that happens as a child. You know, there's another line I just read not very long ago that I find really interesting that might take us in a different direction or might not. And it is by this guy who wrote a novel, Caleb Carr. It is that, there was no arguing, this is from a novel, there was no arguing his belief that what most men consider their rationally selected actions are in fact idiosyncratic responses established during the decisive experiences of childhood that have grown strong enough through repeated use to overpower other urges and reactions. Mm. And what I took that to mean is that, you know, last fall we did this event called, okay, actually hold on for just a second because I shut my door and I have a cat yelling to get out, so hold on, I have to go serve the cat.
First things first.
Anyway, we did this event last fall called Earth at Risk, and one of the panels at it that I really liked was called Sociopathology and Capitalism, or Capitalism and Sociopathology, I don't remember which. And on it were myself and Charles Derber and Stephanie McMillan, and we had a very friendly disagreement that I've been having with Stephanie for years, and I'm now having with Charles Derber, which was that they both primarily believe that capitalism creates sociopathological behavior. I completely agree with that. And my take on it, though, is that it took sociopaths to create capitalism, and that they both basically, I'm mischaracterizing their work, but I'm doing the best I can, that they both believe that the material conditions and the material reward system of capitalism create sociopathological behavior. Once again, I completely agree with that. But I think central to a lot of my work is that I think that people, when they create ideologies, I think that quite often they're fundamentally lying to themselves and to other people. And I think that, you know, I'm really influenced by Robert J. Lifton and what he said about claims to virtue and how before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to convince yourself and others that what you're doing is not, in fact, an atrocity, but instead you're doing a good. So from their own perspective, the Nazis weren't killing Jews. They were purifying the Aryan race. They were doing a good thing from their perspective. And in the United States, they weren't committing genocide against American Indians and aren't, but instead are manifesting their destiny. And people right now are not destroying the world. They're developing natural resources. And I know this is true on a personal level. You know, I have never in my life been a jerk. Of course I've been a jerk. But every time I've ever been a jerk, I've had it fully rationalized, and I was not actually being a jerk. I was doing this good thing that, you know, anybody from the outside would recognize that I was lying to myself and lying to everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so when you put that on a larger scale, I think that I have to be really when I read anybody's analysis, I have to, oh, I'm going to do another quote, because that's actually the last thing. I don't know if people know this, but as I write books, and this is true for a fair number of writers, that we don't actually break the books. I don't break the book into a chapter until the very end. Chapters are meaningless to me. All they are breaks for readers. So I write a book all the way through. It's just one long piece. And then at the end, I break it in chapters and find epigraphs. And so I've spent the last couple of weeks finding epigraphs. And I found a great one that I used early on in this book, which is the modern conservative, and I would say every human supremacist, is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy, that is, the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness. And ultimately, that's what I think a lot of this culture's philosophy, a lot of its science, a lot of its religion, is really just justification for really poor behavior. And I don't think, I want to be really clear, I don't think that that is true for every mythology and every culture. I think that every mythology and every culture will help to rationalize and support that particular way of life, but not every way of life is based on, you know, being as having a central violation imperative. There are ways of life that had entirely different stories. It's like they've shown, let's see, Peggy Reeve Sanday tried to find out why some cultures are high rape and some are low or no rape. And what she found is pretty interesting, that a lot of the things we'd expect, if it's highly militarized, it's probably high rape. If women and children are treated poorly in general, it's probably high rape. But one of the things she found that was, I thought was really interesting, was that if the creator stories have a male deity who is the creator, then it's probably high rape. And if it has either a couple or a female creator deity, then it's probably low rape. And I bring that up right now just to show the absolute power of stories, that if you can have a story about creation where the God is a male who is the creator of the universe by himself, just imagine how that valorizes men and devalorizes women right there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that's sort of a meander through the whole man question, that I think that within this culture, our manhood itself for us men is based on perceiving ourselves as, you know, I was in a restaurant one time and I overheard these two people at the next table, and they said this thing that was just perfect. One of them said to the other one, "Man, I am in such pain these days." And the other guy said, "When are you going to stop being such a woman and crying about your pain?" I was like, there we go, right there. You know, manhood is cutting yourself off from your feelings of empathy, even with your own body.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is that's obviously a huge problem, is not only cutting oneself off from one's own feelings, but cutting oneself off from one's empathy with others. Mm-hmm. And that's something that needs to be just gotten rid of as much as possible.
Yeah. Well, this takes me into the next area that I wanted to visit with you, which is pathology. I'm learning an awful lot, to my satisfaction, about the immensity of the pain that sits mostly unconsciously deep, deep, deep in the early brains of almost everyone, especially being born into a culture that is already so disturbed that we are acculturated to repression and splitting away from our feelings, and in the modern times even more than ever, moving almost entirely into the cognitive and verbal and present tense brain, the cortex. That's why when it became clear that we were going to have an interview, I started revisiting my experiences with your thoughts and how you had the great gift of your work has been to open yourself heart and soul to all of us, and to give us an almost unique experience of having, especially a male, own or express or acknowledge the entire feeling dimension of life that is no more no more feminine or no more masculine than feminine. It's human, and it's and we're dying from the being split off from it. A language older than words refers to our entire emotional sensorium and our entire intuitive and preverbal and precognitive experience as living beings, and we're impoverished by being split off from that. And I want to read this is the second and last quote that I wanted to take out of this book. This book was published some 15 years ago, written some 15 or 16 or 17 years ago. The quote is, in order for us to maintain this way of living, our way of living, we must, in a broad sense, tell lies to each other, and especially to ourselves. It is not necessary that the lies be particularly believable. The lies act as barriers to truth. These barriers are necessary. These barriers to truth are necessary because without them, many deplorable acts would become impossibilities. And we can look at the front page of the newspaper, any doodah day and see the utter depravity and the unconsciousness and the cruelty, of what passes for normal. And, it's ghastly and it's terminal. And if we don't give this our fullest attention and start to take all this stuff apart like you do in your writing career, you know, we're a goner, and there are many people who feel we're a goner now. It's too late for us now. And I just want to just to wrap it up, I want to say that Freud in his day spoke of the normal neurotic, and I think now we're starting to see more and more the normal psychotic, that we're acculturated, we're habituated to what seems to be normal, and that normal is has become a monstrous lie.
Yeah, and well, thank you for saying all that. Thank you for saying that about my work, and then also thank you for all that really great analysis in there of this culture that you just said. It's really fabulous, and I'm thinking of one of my favorite book titles ever. It was by this book by this guy by the name of Arno Gruen. It was called The Insanity of Normality. Very, very good book. And I'm thinking of, you know, I've been thinking about cell phones and about computers, and I just recently, my mom has been trying to get me to get a cell phone for years and years now, and I finally succumbed to that, and I'm only going to use it when I'm on the road or something. But I was thinking about that a lot, and how
that's what they all say.
What?
I said that's what they all say.
Yeah, and the point of me bringing it up is that means I've been thinking about cell phones more and thinking about how so much of this computer technology, including cell phones, is all about even more decreasing our relationship to place. And how with a landline, at least, you know, I have to be home to take a call. And I have to be in a physical space. But with a cell phone, I am divorced even from that place. And by itself, you know, I don't want to make too big a deal of this, because by itself, I don't think that's a huge deal. But when you combine that with, you know, one of the things that I've been saying for years about religions is that any religion is supposed to teach us how to live, and living sustainably means living in place, and living sanely means living in place. And how, let's say you have a religion like any of the monotheists, like say Christianity, it, you know, it's problematical anyway, you know, the male creator deity, all those things. But even if it would have worked in the Near East 2,000 years ago, that doesn't mean that it's relevant to teach me how to live in the rainforests of Northern California. And in fact, a religion that claims to be universal, by definition, is not going to be place-based, because we can see that one would live differently in a salmon-based community in the Pacific Northwest than in a community that was in the desert of Arizona or in the forests of what's now Massachusetts. And one would have to live differently, which means that one's religion would have to come from place. So the only reason I mention the cell phone thing is that it is, and it's the same with computers and accessing the internet, that it is by definition placeless. And it's not merely, once again, by itself, I don't think it's that big a deal. I'm not going to freak out about it. But on the other hand, I want to just put it in the context of this culture's several thousand year history of increasingly divorcing itself from physical location. And that doesn't really now I've sort of gone off on a little side direction with that, but it's not really a side direction, Vine Deloria would have said, because I think that there is a relationship between, well, Vine Deloria would say there's a relationship between living in place and being more sane. But even if we drop that off, you know, I was just making a list the other day, and maybe you can add some to this list. I was talking to Chris Hedges, it was a couple, 3 months ago. We were making a list of writers who have spoken of this culture's death urge and this, not humanity, I'm not talking, I'm very clear that the Talawa living where I live now, they lived here for at least 12,500 years. They didn't destroy the place. And we didn't need to never presume that the problems of this culture are the problems of humanity in general, that there are other cultures who have lived more sanely. But anyway, we were compiling a list of writers who have written about this culture's death urge. And there's, of course, Freud, and there's Lewis Mumford, there's Eric Fromm, and there's Mary Daly, who talked about how there's only one religion in the world right now, and it's patriarchy, and the religion of patriarchy is necrophilia. And there's me. I'm trying to think, do you know of any other writers off the top of your head who have written extensively of this culture's death urge?
Well, you know, if I gave it some thought, I could probably come up with a few.
Paul Levy is doing it.
I just got off the phone a couple of weeks ago with Morris Berman, who's written extensively about the death of this culture. But you know, I want to intervene here. Please forgive me, this is important. I think I want to tell you and our listeners that I just have come into possession of a book that seems monumental to me, and it's all about death, and it's about what the author, among other things, calls the death-phobic culture that we live in, and how we make attempts to manage death, and how we take the very meaning not only out of death but out of our lives. Anyway, that's only you know, a quick little footnote. The book is called Die Wise. It's subtitled A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul. It's written by a man named Stephen Jenkinson, and it should be published in about 6 weeks. And I've been reading it with having my breath taken away on every sentence virtually. So I wanted to put that right into this slot right here and just kind of announce this book that I think is extraordinarily valuable and monumentally helpful to all of us understand ourselves and our culture. And it's called Die Wise. Back to you.
You know, a couple of things on that. One is, it's very interesting you mentioned that, because I had not heard of that person until maybe 3 weeks ago, and I think you're the third person to recommend that person's work since then. So obviously there's something in the air with that. And the second thing I wanted to say is that that it's really clear to me that so much of this culture's pathology does spring from a fear of death and from a fear of the giving back that is necessary in death. That's one of the things that's central to all of my work, is that it's so clear to me that the admission price to this wonderful thing called life is death. That, you know, I have to feed everybody else, and that's what I pay for, you know, everybody feeds everybody else. There's this great line by, oh man, I'm so sorry, I'm gonna get this wrong. I have this block on this person's name. I never can remember if it's Charlotte Perkins Gilmore or Charlotte Perkins Gilman, the one who wrote Yellow Wallpaper. And I always get it wrong. So it's one of those two names. Anyway, she has this great line about how the Buddha went out and walked into the world and saw that everybody was, killing each other to eat. And that was a horrifying thing. And she just changed one word and it changed everything. She said, I go out into the world and I see that everybody's feeding each other and it's beautiful. And I love that. And that's an entirely different way to look at the world. There's a line by Mark Twain too, that basically if you've lived well, you know, you don't need to be afraid of dying. And, I think that, from my perspective, at least, a lot of our problems with death come from a fear of giving back that we only want to take. We don't think that. I just read this horrible, horrible, horrible thing the other day by some real technotopian type guy who was saying that he wants to bring about the end of death, and he thinks it's outrageous that humans actually die. And yeah, exactly. And he wants to put scientists onto that to have us figure out. It's an outrage that this most wonderful creature in the universe actually has to die. And what that is that's a profound hatred of the process of living itself. Really? And that's a hatred of all life.
Really?
And I think that in many ways that's the source of, you know, I was reading this thing. And as I was working on the Human Supremacism book, I read this thing about how these scientists were describing a perspective that seems outrageous at first, but I think, and it is outrageous, but I think it is actually very common in this culture, and it's that, excuse me, it's that there is, I'll see if I can find the exact quote, it is metaphysical naturalism. Okay, it's not actually natural at all. They keep calling it naturalism, but it's the notion that nature is within material reality, only human artifacts possess intelligent form and intelligent functionality or purpose. Measurable biological patterns lack intelligibility in themselves. Similarly, biological functionality is not true functionality, but merely resembles the functionality of human engineering. So, natural functionality doesn't count. So we presume, and this is enshrined in this culture's everything. I mean, like water rights in the West are assigned by what's called prior use, prior beneficial use. And what's considered a beneficial use is if you take water out of the river and then you use it for agriculture or industry. And that's considered a beneficial use as opposed to, I just read this quote in the newspaper not very long ago by some people who want to take water from Northern California down to Southern California or Central California for the farms. They said there's all this water just going to the ocean being wasted. And that's the notion right there, that a forest by itself, and you know, we can say, oh yeah, they're being extreme, but honestly, standing trees are not worth a dime. You know, they're only turned into something, they're only worth something when they're cut down and made into 2x4s. And it's same with water in a river, same with anything in here. And this notion that, okay, so a year ago, okay, about a year and a month ago, in December of 2013, I started having chest pain. And this is going to have a point. I started having chest pain. And I thought it was either heartburn or heart trouble. But because I didn't have any insurance, I presumed it was heartburn because I couldn't pay for the test to figure out, which of course is crazy, but that's how things work when you don't have insurance. And that's how things work when you don't want to face a bigger problem. Yeah. So then I eventually found out that things got a little bit better, but not much. And I eventually got, I'm one of the people for whom Obamacare really works and it's great now. But anyway, after a while I got on Obamacare. I went to a cardiologist and he said, well, you have a clogged artery to your heart. I said, well, okay, this is really interesting to me because the symptoms actually have gotten better in the last couple, 3 months. They're still bad, but they've gotten better. And here's what he said that just blew me away. He said, that's because your body was performing cardiac bypass surgery.
Uh-huh.
And what he means by that is when your body recognizes that an artery is clogged, it throws out capillaries to go around the blockage.
Yeah.
And now here's my real point. We think it's miraculous and amazing when a human doctor will perform bypass surgery. But what about when your body does it?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Why do we, and my point is, this is like in the lab, they get so excited because they just made an enzyme or something. It's like, and they talk about making life in a lab.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but, you know, rabbits make life all the time. And so do mice. And so do, and it's like, there's this astronomer, it just killed me. This astronomer said why we have to, and this is the heart of what's wrong with patriarchy. This astronomer said why we have to explore Mars is because he said it will answer that most important question of all, which is, are we all alone? It's like, dude, look around. You know, we are so not alone. There are, you know, just a bazillion other beings all around us all the time. And so I think part of the problem, and this goes back to that, that's where the violation imperative comes from, is this belief that only what we do matters. I love the line by Eric Fromm, I affect, therefore I am. And, you know, affect, what we forget. I mean, so people think that if you haven't made your mark, if you haven't built a Mount Rushmore, if you haven't clear-cut a forest, you're nothing. But you can affect others by love too. You can affect others by actually improving. Here's the central question I think that we all need to ask is the world a better place because you were born? And I don't mean by that the culture. I don't mean did you help make an interstate highway? I mean the real physical world. Are there more salmon in the world because you were born? Are there more, is there less dioxin in every mother's breast milk because you were born? Is there, are the oceans healthier because you were born? And that's a fundamental problem in this culture too, is this belief that, I mean, how does anybody think that the world got to be so wild and fecund and beautiful in the first place? The reason and the way it got to be so wild and fecund and beautiful is because every creature, by living and dying, was making the world a better place. That's how else did it get to be so amazing? It got to be so amazing because everyone contributes to the actual physical world. And what's happened is that this culture has come along and it's been then stealing everything. And it's extraordinary to me that people can't, that more people can't recognize the, that any way of life based on drawdown and based on destroying that can't continue. That's something that I've written 20 some books about. I still don't understand. It's so obvious to me that if you have 6 billion passenger pigeons and then 4 billion and then 2 billion and then 1 billion, eventually you'll have none. I don't understand why people who pride themselves on being the most intelligent creature on the planet can't understand basic trends of, you know, if there's only 1% of the native forests left and 1% of the native grasslands, that suggests to me that things are going the wrong direction.
There are many forces at play. There are many elements, and we absolutely must keep our shoulders to the wheel and keep studying all the different forces that have come into making the 21st century. And there are ways through this. We either haven't found them, or we are in the grip of a terrible pathological condition of unconsciousness. Or I think the immensity of the pain inside so many people is more than most people are willing to even go near. And it may be a hard piece of news, but I think it's true enough that if we're going to have any future whatsoever, let alone a glorious future, which is also ours for the having, if we would strap it on and find our mature responsibility and our courage, it's going to take us through a lot of pain, a lot of personal and collective pain. We've committed terrible crimes. There's a certain amount of guilt and shame that absolutely has to be felt and gone through. And it's not pretty, but that's the deal. And I hold out almost no hope that we're going to succeed, because I think characterologically we come up short. I think we would much rather play it out, becoming fascinated with the Oscars and the Super Bowl, than go anywhere near any of these issues that you've raised in your work, and you know, hundreds and thousands of other people all over the world working day and night to try to interrupt this death spiral. I think we have everything we need to succeed, except the stomach for it.
I agree. And I keep thinking about, you know, years ago I talked to a fisheries biologist, about what happens when dams fail. Does it harm the river? And this one fisheries biologist said that there's a river she works on a lot and studies a lot and loves a lot. And whenever the river, and you know, we misdefine rivers, that rivers actually ride across the landscape like snakes. You know, they don't just stay in a channel. They are supposed to jump channels all the time. And this particular river that she loves, she said every time there's a flood and it changes channels, it breaks her heart, because there's all these fish and trees and frogs who die, and then at the same time, it makes her really happy, because she recognizes that that's how new habitat is created. And the phrase she said that really struck me was that when there's a flood like that, you have short-term habitat loss for long-term habitat gain. And when she said that to me, it struck me, why do people stay in relationships they're not happy with? It's because they're afraid of that short-term loss for the long-term gain. And why do people stay in jobs they don't like? It's because of the fear of short-term loss versus the long-term gain. And I know for myself, you know, I remember the very first day, you know, I have not always been as strong an advocate for the body as I am now. I remember the first day I was ever in therapy, one of the first questions the therapist asked me was, so how do you feel? And I looked at him and I said, I don't even know what you're talking about. And he said, well, I'm feeling the sun on my shoulders, and I'm feeling a little bit excited because you're a new client. And I said, oh, I get it. You know, it's like, you're asking how I feel. Like, okay, I'm sitting on a couch and I feel warm. But my point is, I didn't even know what he was talking about. And my point, and then I'll tell you one more thing. I haven't talked about this in public, but about 5 or 6 years into the therapy, I asked him, so do you, you know, has there been a time that you've been kind of nervous about what I've been doing in here or something like that? He said, well, I got to tell you that you've been working so fast. I mean, you've been making changes, and at first I thought that you were basically just being the good student and like faking the changes so that I would approve of you. Mm. And I said, well, that's crazy. Why would I come to therapy? Why would I pay for therapy if I'm just going to fake things? And he said, you would be surprised at how many people come to therapy but don't really want to change. And I said, for God's sake, of course I wanted to change. I was miserable. And that's the point, is that, yes, it was really hard work, and it's really hard work to become a writer, and it's really hard work to do any of these things. It's really hard work to become a human being when we are – now, there's this great line by – who's the guy, the cherry orchard? Chekhov. Anton Chekhov. Some young writer said, you know, I don't know what to write about. What should I write about? And Chekhov said, I want you to write a story about a person who squeezes every drop of slave's blood out of their body. And that process of recognizing the horror of what you have done and the horror of what you have allowed to be done is an incredibly painful and difficult process, and most people don't want to do it. It's like you say, they would rather watch the Super Bowl. And that's one of the things that does not give me a lot of optimism for the future, is that this work is so hard on an individual level. And then add to that, on the cultural level, you know, it's even bigger. But I want to put in a couple other things, which is, when I was maybe 27 or 28, I was calling myself a writer, but I wasn't really writing very much. And I remember one day, it was one of the most important days of my life, I was thinking, oh, I can't write this thing because, you know, I was abused as a kid and I just don't have the self-esteem and I don't have that. And then it suddenly occurred to me, it's like, okay, I can go the rest of my life having the best excuse in the world for not doing what I want, or I can just roll up my sleeves and do what I want. And that was an incredibly important realization. Yeah, it's really hard work, but there is something on the other side, and that's what I want to give people, is that there is something on the other side. And yeah, it's really hard work, and it's really painful. You know, writing a language older than words was incredibly difficult for me, because that process raised up a lot of issues. I sometimes look at emotional issues as though they are living beings. And they might actually be living beings, I don't know. But those living beings didn't want to die. My defense mechanisms that I had put in place didn't want to give up. And I had to struggle very hard, and they fought me. I had nightmares. I wrote that whole book pretty much very sleep deprived, because the nightmares I'd had my whole life became so extreme that I wasn't sleeping. I basically wouldn't sleep at all, and then at maybe 6 o'clock I might fall asleep, drift for a couple hours with these terrible nightmares, and then get up and write. And that was an incredibly difficult process, but the good thing is the nightmare stopped when the book was over. And, you know, within a year or two after.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't have nightmares.
It makes sense,
at all
doesn't it?
Absolutely. And so I just want to encourage people. Yeah, it's really painful and really hard, but you can come out the other side.
Well, I want to encourage our listeners who haven't, to read A Language Older Than Words. Just leave it at that, and then you might have an appetite to move on to the culture of make-believe, or Strangely Like War.
Are you there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Oh, I can now. It wasn't for a second. Okay,
all
great.
All right. Yeah, I was just touting a string of your early books. You know, I wanted to, just so I don't leave it out, you spoke maybe 10 minutes ago about trees, and you often speak about trees. And I'm sure you're familiar with Andy Lipkus in Los Angeles, the tree people.
No.
You're not. I guess maybe a couple of years ago I had him on the telephone. And the things that he has to teach us and show us about trees, and what he's done in his life with the tree population in Los Angeles and environs is absolutely stunning. So I'm surprised you haven't heard of Tree People and Andy Lipkus. We had the great, I don't know what to call him, I'll just say his name, Brock Dolman, when I was in California. We had him in the studio and Andy Lipkus on the telephone. And what trees do in terms of, serving the water needs of a locality, and I'm not even going to try to paraphrase, the genius of ecosystems or of trees or water or anything like that. I just wanted to raise his name to associate with your frequent reference to trees.
Oh, well, thank you for that. And if you could send me his name, I would love to research him.
I will. Derek, would you be willing to talk to us a little bit about the muse or your muse? I don't know if you still do, but you used to refer to your muse when writing.
Oh, absolutely. And I can probably go about another 10 minutes, then I need to head into town.
Sure.
I don't believe that the muse is when I talk about the muse or my muse, I'm not talking about a projection of my unconscious or anything like that. I don't actually write my books. The muse writes them, and the muse is an actual being who is not, doesn't have form. I basically contribute, opposable thumbs so I can write it down and then I edit.
You're the secretary. You're the secretary.
But my ego wants to take a bit more credit. I'm a secretary I'm an administrative secretary. There we go. Because I also have the right to edit some, you know? Yeah. Anyway, yeah. Exactly. I'm the scribe. And the, I was reading, who was that woman? I didn't read the book, but I saw a talk by the woman who wrote Eat, Pray, Love. And the talk was pretty interesting. It was about how up until the so-called enlightenment, which I just hate that phrase. Anyway, up until the so-called enlightenment, basically anyone would have, everybody presumed that muses are real. And it's only been the last 200 years or so that we presume that artists actually create their own work. And, the muse is a being who, I have no idea if she works with other people or not. If there's like one muse for everybody, I think, or if we each have our own, I'm presuming that we have a relationship. What I know is that when I try to write just on my own, it's not usually very good. And, the stuff that, most of the stuff I write comes pretty quickly. And it has to be worked, but there can be a long time sitting waiting for the good stuff. I write crap, 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 and then that all gets thrown away. And then one of the things I've learned over 20 some years of writing is that, I've learned to write, I've learned when I'm writing crap. I've learned when I'm writing stuff from myself as opposed to from the muse. I read this thing by, Amy Tan. Somebody asked her once, so, does the writing ever get easier? A young writer asked her. She said, no, it never gets easier. It just gets better. And that's not been my experience at all. My experience was that I was writing stuff from a place. It was really, really hard to write. And the hard thing was finding the place where the writing is easy. But then once I found that door, once I opened up the door and established that relationship with the muse, or once she established it with me, then it became really, really much easier as long as I can find that place. And oftentimes I'll be writing and I'll try to write and I'll try to write, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And then I get stuck and I'll say, I need some help. Can you answer this for me? Can you go ahead and write this? And she'll provide. She writes the stuff, and it's very, very important to me to acknowledge this muse. For many reasons, one of which is that it's simply true, and another is that it's, if I were giving things to people, to someone, like say I've got a friendship, and I'm always giving something to this person, and they never say thank you, it's like, well, screw you, I'm not gonna give you any more if you're not grateful. And so it's very important to me to do whatever it takes to, maintain that relationship and to make her as happy as she makes me. Mm-hmm. And it's very clear to me that this is not the personification of the unconscious, for me at least. I don't know how other people look at it. And it's not just the muse, by the way. The muse is not the only person who helps me out. It used to be that I thought that I was just very peripatetic, that if I get stuck, sometimes I'll take a walk. And what I found is that there are some parts of the forest where I get a lot more comes to me. And I mean, it's very clear to me that trees give me some of that too. And, I mean, I'll be walking through the forest and I'll be asking questions, and then, you know, a tree or someone else will just give me the answer. And that's a big problem too, is that there's this presumption that if you, actually listen to those voices, that, you know, you must be crazy or something. But that's how humans have lived for almost all of our existence.
Really?
It's much less lonely, you know. Yeah. You're in this world of, you know, I was talking to Brian DeLore about this years ago, and one of the things I said to him was that Jeanette Armstrong has said to me, I said to Jeanette Armstrong, who's an Okanagan Indian, where do dreams come from? And she said, oh, everybody knows the animals give them to us. And I asked Vine Deloria, and he was from the plains, and his people were from the plains. He was Dakota, and he said, well, the Great Spirit gives them to us. And I said, what's the difference? Why do you say this? Why are these differences? And he started laughing and said, it's because we live in different places, and in different places you have different creatures, and you're going to have entirely different cosmologies, and you're going to have different psychic problems that you deal with. And he said that, for example, if you live in if you live in a rainforest, you're going to have a lot of psychic energy that's impinging on yours all the time. And so a lot of your cosmology has to be, how do I keep hitchhikers from jumping into me? How do I maintain a sense of personal integrity, by which I just mean wholeness, when you have all these other beings who are, it's like walking through a room where there's all these conversations going on, and how do you navigate that? And I think that's, once again, that takes us back to living in a far more complex universe. It's much easier to walk through a universe where there's only one voice there's only one voice, and that's yours. It's also really lonely, and it's psychopathological.
This normality of this culture at this time is just miserable. It's just, this is crazy. You know, whatever is often spoken of as crazy is the leaking out of life that we seem to hate life, or we're terrified of it. Who knows? I'm pretty much done, Derek.
Okay, well, thank you so much. It was a great interview.
I want to make sure that you, if you can, jot it down to catch up with a film called The Homesman. You probably missed it. I don't think it played in Crescent City, but it's called The Homesman. And, you'll jot it down and catch up with it someday. And, we'll talk again, and I'll send you that business about Andy Lipkus.
That sounds great. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Thank you for your work. Have a great day.